This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Say goodbye to performance-robbing engine deposits with Shell V-Power Nitro Plus Premium Gasoline. Hate to break it to you, but lower-grade fuel can leave deposits in your engine that build up over time and leave your engine's performance severely lacking. Thankfully, Shell V-Power Nitro Plus removes up to 100% of performance-robbing deposits with continuous use in gasoline direct injection engine fuel injectors. Download the Shell app today to find your nearest Shell station and rejuvenate your engine with Shell V-Power Nitro Plus Premium Gasoline. Fuel up at Shell.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Anyone who tells you that Donald Trump is not going to be a tough opponent is kidding themselves. He is getting unbelievable amounts of money from his billionaire friends, and they have a strong base of support.
Senator Bernie Sanders is now the Democratic frontrunner. Could he beat President Trump? And will his democratic socialist message stand up to more moderate views in his own party?
One of the criticisms of you in the Senate, Joe Biden has said that you never got anything done. Amy Klobuchar has been... Are you getting mad?
I'm bad. I'm just...
You exhaled
just
in a way.
Silently hissing, that's all.
298 men, women, and children were murdered while traveling from Amsterdam to Malaysia after an anti-aircraft missile shredded their airliner over Ukraine. No one has ever taken responsibility. But tonight, you will hear the evidence and the testimony of those who lost family in such an unimaginable way.
I want to know who killed my children.
This musical prodigy has been performing around the world since he was 11 years old. And he's blind, which caught the attention of this neuroscientist who wanted to see what would happen inside his brain.
Okay, should we give it a shot?
Yep.
The part that's used for sight when he listens to music.
This is what changes in his brain.
Jeez. Lights up.
I'm Leslie Stahl.
I'm Bill Whitaker.
I'm Anderson Cooper.
I'm Sharon Alfonsi.
I'm Scott Pelley. Those stories and more tonight on 60 Minutes.
Sound the gifting panic alarm. We've all been there. You need to find the perfect gift. You have absolutely zero ideas and you don't know where to start. Relax. Now you can use gift mode on Etsy. Gift mode takes the stress out of gifting, so you can find the perfect item for anyone and any occasion. Just answer a few short questions about who you're shopping for and what they like, and gift mode gives you curated gift ideas based on hundreds of personas. Imagine pages of artisan espresso mugs for the coffee connoisseur in your life. Or for the pickleballer, customized paddle covers in every shade imaginable. Etsy's got you covered.
Need to find the perfect gift? Don't panic. Try Gift Mode on Etsy now.
Bernie Sanders had an impressive win last night in the Nevada caucuses. He also won in the New Hampshire primary and leads the Democratic field in national polls. It's a stunning turn of events for a man who calls himself a Democratic socialist and is the first to admit he's been preaching the same populist progressive message for decades. As the mayor of Burlington, Vermont, then a U.S. congressman, now an independent senator who caucuses with the Democrats, Sanders has been arguing that the very rich should pay higher taxes so that everyone can have health care, education, and a decent-paying job. Sanders is 78 years old and is filling arenas with huge crowds of young, enthusiastic supporters. He's used to being the underdog, but now grudgingly has to admit in the Democratic race for president, he's the frontrunner.
After your entire career, to now be the frontrunner of the Democratic
Party. Yes, that is a bit shocking. I will agree. I will agree with you there.
The Democratic Party has moved to you, if anything.
In many ways, they have. And the ideas that seemed radical 4 years ago are now kind of mainstream.
The ideas are still pretty radical. I mean, you've been saying with pride that you're making a lot of people nervous. You said Wall Street's getting nervous, the insurance industry is getting nervous, drug companies are getting nervous, and the Democratic establishment is getting nervous.
Yep, that's what I said.
You know what? They should be getting nervous.
You're also making, though, a lot of Democratic voters nervous.
I don't think so. Look, you know, you have a lot of candidates out there, and each candidate has his or her supporters.
But a lot of voters are voting for candidates who aren't calling for Medicare for all, who aren't calling for a revolution. Is everybody really wanting a revolution like that?
Let's go easy on the word political revolution. You know, we're trying to follow.
You're the one who's using the word.
I mean, you know, but I don't want people, you know, to overstate them. But here is the point. It's not good enough to complain, oh, I cannot afford my health care. I can't afford child care. I can't afford to send my kid to college. I'm paying half of my income in rent. You know, if you're not happy about that, you've got to be involved in the political process. Only millions of people standing up for justice can bring about the kind of change that this country requires. And I believe that has got to happen.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sanders says the change he envisions most closely resembles Scandinavian and European countries with democratic governments and comprehensive social programs. But that's certainly not how President Trump has characterized it.
Well, I think he's a communist.
And it's not just President Trump. At the debate this past week in Las Vegas, this is how former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg responded to one of Sanders' proposals to require greater employee ownership of large companies.
I can't think of a ways that would make it easier for Donald Trump to get reelected than listening to this conversation. It's ridiculous. We're not going to throw out capitalism. We tried that. Other countries tried that. It was called communism, and it just didn't work.
You said it was a cheap shot that he said. What's going to happen on the stage with President Trump? He's going to be doing shots all the time on you on this.
And you know what? We will fight back, and this is what we will bring up. We will bring up is that the president of the United States is a pathological liar. And it is increasingly clear that many people just don't believe anything that he says. He is a fraud. I look forward to taking him on.
What is democratic socialism?
When Donald Trump was a private businessman in New York, he got $800 million in tax breaks and subsidies to build luxury housing. That's called corporate socialism. What democratic socialism is about is saying, let's use the federal government to protect the interests of working families.
Back in the 1980s, Sanders had some positive things to say about the former Soviet Union and the Sandinistas in Nicaragua.
And everybody was totally convinced.
Here he is explaining why the Cuban people didn't rise up and help the U.S. overthrow Cuban leader Fidel Castro.
He educated their kids, gave them health care, totally transformed the society.
We're very opposed to the authoritarian nature of Cuba. But, you know, it's unfair to simply say everything is bad. You know, when Fidel Castro came into office, you know what he did? He had a massive literacy program. Is that a bad thing, even though Fidel Castro did it?
There's a lot of dissidents imprisoned in Cuba.
That's right, and we condemn that. Unlike Donald Trump, let's be clear, I do not think that Kim Jong-un is a good friend. I don't trade love letters with a murdering dictator. Vladimir Putin, not a great friend of mine.
A month ago, Sanders was told by U.S. intelligence that Vladimir Putin's government has been attempting to help his campaign. And last week, lawmakers were briefed that Moscow is also trying to help re-elect President Trump.
On Friday, Sanders offered this message to Putin.
And again, as president of the United States, Mr. Putin, you will not interfere in our elections.
You believe winning absolutely relies on a voter turnout that this country has never seen before.
That's right. I think, look, anyone who tells you that Donald Trump is not going to be a tough opponent is kidding themselves. The way you beat Trump is bring non-traditional voters into the political process.
Donald Trump got elected talking to white middle-class Americans, white working-class Americans, promising to make America great again. Your stump speech, your critics say, sounds like nothing works in America, hasn't for generations. Is America great?
In many ways, we are. In some ways, very significant ways, we're not. We're not great when half of our people today are living paycheck to paycheck. When 500,000 people tonight are going to be sleeping out on the streets, including 30,000 veterans. You know, my father came to this country at the age of 17 without a nickel in his pocket. Couldn't speak a word of English, had very limited education. We are a great nation because people like my father would never have dreamed in a million years that their kids would become United States senators or be successful in many other ways.
How much of your political beliefs are based on your experiences growing up in Brooklyn with your family?
A lot, Anderson, a lot. I grew up, and I don't want to hear anyone to think we were desperately poor. We were not. My father worked every day of his life. He worked very hard, just never made a whole lot of money. And, you know, as a kid, it stays with you your whole life. These are the things you don't forget. The incredible arguments between my mom and my dad over money. You know, why didn't we have enough money to do this? And should we buy this and do that? And why are you buying this clothing? And blah, 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 blah.
Your mom got sick when you were a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
Does that inform your view on medical policy, on Medicare for All, and all of that?
I don't like to talk about personal stuff that much, but it does.
It's interesting you don't like to talk a lot about personal stuff. Most people running on a campaign, they want people to know that side of them. Why do you think that's not important?
I'm not saying it's not important. I mean, I'm a kind of private person in a sense, and I not particularly anxious to tell the world about everything personal in my life.
One of the things obviously people do know about is you had a heart attack a few months ago. If you're elected running for a second term, you'd be 82 years old. Somebody running for a second term at 82, shouldn't that give voters pause?
Well, I haven't won the first term yet, so let's, we'll see what happens on the second term. You know, being old has an advantage in the sense that the issues that I fight for are not new to me.
One of the criticisms of you in the Senate, Joe Biden has said that you never got anything done. Amy Klobuchar has been, are you getting mad?
I'm mad. I'm just,
you exhale
just
in a way.
Silently hissing, that's all.
Amy Klobuchar has said to be a progressive, you have to make progress, implying you haven't. Georgetown University studied that you had one of the worst records for bipartisan cooperation in the Senate.
Oh, boy. Dead wrong, dead wrong, dead wrong. When I was in the House year after year after year, I passed more bipartisan amendments than anybody else in the House.
In terms of getting your bills through Congress, we found, I think, seven bills that you were the primary sponsor on that got enacted. Two of them were involved naming post office buildings.
Yeah, but if you look at the Affordable Care Act, my name was not on that bill. But you speak to anybody in Congress. I led the effort to bring $11 billion more into community health centers and expand our primary health care in this country. I mean, as you well know, Anderson, Congress is a complicated place.
There is profound skepticism in Congress about Sanders' ability to get his agenda passed. Two-thirds of Democrats in the Senate haven't signed on to Medicare for All, which would cost an estimated $30 to $40 trillion over 10 years. And that's just one of Bernie Sanders' many proposals. There's also free public college, cancellation of all student debt, a federal job guarantee, and a Green New Deal to rapidly reduce carbon emissions.
How much will that cost?
Obviously, those are expensive propositions, but we have done our best on issue after issue in paying for them.
Do you know how much, though? I mean, do you have a price tag for all this?
We do. I mean, the price tag is, it will be substantially less than letting the current system go. I think it's about $30 trillion.
That's just for Medicare for All.
Just Medicare
about.
For All, yes.
Do you have a price tag for all of these things?
No, I don't. You mentioned making public colleges and universities tuition-free and canceling all student debt. That's correct. That's what I want to do. We pay for that through a modest tax on Wall Street speculation.
But you say you don't know what the total price is, but you know how it's going to be paid for. How do you know it's going to be paid for if you don't know how much the price is?
Well, I can't rattle off to you every nickel and every dime, but we have accounted for it. You talked about Medicare for All. We have options out there that will pay for it.
Taxes on corporations and billionaires are the primary options he's proposed. But to finance Medicare for All, middle-class families would also pay an additional 4% tax on their income over $29,000. Sanders says they'll end up saving money because they won't have to pay premiums, co-pays, or deductibles. But under Medicare for All, nearly 160 million Americans will have to give up their private health insurance.
Isn't that a dangerous message for Democrats to say, you know what, we're going to take away your private insurance, we're going to give you something better run by the government? A lot of people don't trust
it. It's not run by the government. Medicare allows you to go to any doctor you want, for better or worse. This is not socialized medicine. This is keeping the same system intact, but getting rid of the private insurance companies, giving people another card, which allows them complete freedom.
Though he's campaigning as a champion of the poor, Bernie Sanders became a millionaire 4 years ago, thanks largely to royalties from his best-selling book, Our Revolution. His Democratic rivals have given him some grief about it during the debates.
You know what they're getting at. They're suggesting that it's hypocritical to criticize the wealthy, say they're not fair in their share.
We pay our fair share of taxes.
He doesn't think billionaires like Michael Bloomberg are paying their fair share. Nor does he think much of the job Bloomberg did as mayor.
I think the more people understand Bloomberg's record as mayor of New York, where he engaged in horrifically racist policies of stop and frisk, people in America don't want that.
You have promised to support the Democratic nominee. Personally, though, the idea of you going out campaigning for Michael Bloomberg, a billionaire, how would that even work? I mean, can you honestly tell your supporters to support this billionaire?
Well, I think this is the problem of a Bloomberg candidacy. It's not just my supporters. He is not going to be a strong candidate. But what I have said, you quoted me correctly, is I said on day one, I will support the Democratic nominee, no matter who that nominee may be.
At the end of our interview, Sanders unveiled a new plan that would guarantee free, high-quality child care and pre-kindergarten to every kid in the country from infancy to age 4.
So what we are calling for is universal child care.
How are you going to pay for this?
We have a tax on wealth to pay for that.
For all the people who like the idea of it, there are going to be a lot of Democrats again who are saying, well, wait a minute, yet again, this is another program that it's not clear how it's going to get paid for.
No,
it's just going to add
to... It is clear how it's going to be paid for. Look, Anderson...
But it's more taxes.
It's taxes on billionaires, you know? You know, I get a little bit tired of hearing my opponents saying, gee, how are you going to pay for a program that impacts and helps children or working-class families or middle-class families? How are you going to pay for that? And yet, where are people saying, how are you going to pay for over $750 billion on military spending? How are you going to pay for $1 trillion in tax breaks to the 1% in large corporations, which was what Trump did? When you help the billionaires and you help Wall Street, hey, of course we can pay for it. That's what America's supposed to be about. Well, I disagree.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than just a car or a house. It's the four wheels that get you where you're going and the four walls that welcome you home. When you combine auto and home insurance with Amica, we'll help protect it all. And the more you cover, the more you can save. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
With a single shot, 298 men, women, and children were massacred in Ukraine. The dead were traveling from Amsterdam to Malaysia when an anti-aircraft missile shredded their wide-body airliner. That was 6 years ago, and no one has been held accountable. The downing of Malaysia Flight 17 was a shock to the world. How could innocent civilians leaving the Netherlands on vacation to Asia lose their lives in a war Russia started with Ukraine? After a years-long investigation, Dutch prosecutors say they know who is responsible. This is the story of the hunt for the suspects, now charged with 298 counts of murder. In a Dutch hangar, heavy with the smell of fuel and fire, Malaysia Flight 17 has been resurrected from 8,000 fragments. The Boeing 777, 20 feet wide and 200 feet long, was torn by an estimated 800 pieces of shrapnel, each the size of a bullet. A warhead detonated 10 feet to the left of Captain Eugene Chu's windscreen. The Dutch safety board says the greatest density of holes, 102, is through his window. Shrapnel tore through the cockpit and out the other side. The cockpit sheared away, and the rest of the plane flew another minute and a half. Passengers were thrashed by explosive decompression and a 500-mile-an-hour wind at 40 degrees below zero. One passenger was found wearing his oxygen mask.
I want to know who killed my children.
It was July 17, 2014, that Samira Kaler walked her boys, 19-year-old Shaka and 11-year-old Miguel, as far as Amsterdam airport security would let her. The youngest boy was worried.
He hugged me really tight, and he told me, like, Mom, I'm so afraid to take this plane. You know, I'm so afraid. What happened when the airplane will crash? I told him, Miguel, come on, you've been on flights many times. You are with Shaka. Everything is going just to be fine. He said, you promise me? I said, I promise everything will be okay.
The brothers were going to see their grandmother in Bali. Samira planned to come back to the airport the very next day because her middle son, Mika, couldn't get a seat on Flight 17.
So I never got a proper goodbye, said a proper goodbye, and that really is something that I have to deal with for the rest of my life.
I cannot forgive myself that I promised my baby Miguel that everything will be fine. Who am I to tell him that everything is going to be okay?
That's what a son wants to hear from his mother.
Yeah.
But I feel like I lied to him. Who am I to give him that guarantee? It's been like hell. I feel emptiness. I feel sadness. There is a hole in my heart. It will always hurt, and I miss them every day.
Her boys were among 193 Dutch citizens on board.
It's 9/11 for the Netherlands. The Netherlands, all people in the Netherlands were very, very, very shocked.
Shrines in Dutch homes are common, including the one to Piet Ploeg's brother, sister-in-law, and nephew. His nieces didn't go on their family vacation.
You had to tell your nieces what happened.
I don't want to think too much about that moment. It's too emotional for me. I saw my nieces falling in each other's arms when they realized their parents and their brother were dead. And it was a terrible, terrible moment. Yeah.
No one had any understanding that they were going to be flying over a war zone.
Or you didn't think about it. And after MH17, we always think about it.
Flight 17 was 3 hours into a 12-hour route when it came within range of a war. In 2014, Russia dismembered its neighbor to the west. It annexed part of Ukraine. And today, pro-Russian militias supplied and manned by Moscow are fighting to control eastern Ukraine. In the days before the Flight 17 murders, two Ukrainian military planes were shot down. But despite that, the day Flight 17 entered the airspace, 160 airliners crossed over Ukraine. It was cloudy. Flight 17 at 33,000 feet appeared only on radar until it fell through the clouds across 20 square miles.
We consider it a national crisis because if you think, it was not only that we were doing a criminal investigation, but the most important thing in the beginning was the recovery mission.
Andy Krok is lead investigator for the Netherlands.
First, we needed to recover all the casualties to get them back home so that the next of kin could mourn. Actually, we were in national mourning.
In a nation so small, it seemed everyone knew someone touched by the murders. For days, convoys of hearses stretching beyond sight were met by gauntlets of grief. Fred Vesterbecke is the chief prosecutor who's been on the case from the start.
Have all of the remains been identified?
We were able to identify from the 298 casualties, 296. So for two people, we didn't find any remains.
With no admission of guilt, 350 investigators from five countries began almost 6 years of work.
We started with multiple scenarios in the beginning. One was it an accident that could be discarded quite quickly? The other one, was it an explosion from inside? And the last two, most importantly, was it air-to-air? Like, was it shot by a plane or was it surface-to-air?
Those scenarios narrowed quickly because of a technique new to the police, civilian internet investigators. Just days before the murders, Elliot Higgins started a UK-based group of online detectives that he calls Bellingcat, named for a fable of mice tying a bell to a cat to warn of danger. Higgins found images crowdsourced online.
So this is one of the first videos that was shared online after MH17 was shot down. And it was shared claiming that this was a Buck missile launcher.
And how do you know across all these images that you're looking at the same convoy?
So there's certain details that kind of leap out at us. There's the white truck, but you can see there's a black exhaust pipe on the side of that truck. It's a very small detail, but it does help us show that it's very similar to the truck that's in other photographs and videos.
Matching randomly sourced pictures with geolocation techniques, Higgins and his colleagues spotted an anti-aircraft system in the right place on the right day. Images that had been shot earlier led him to the convoy's starting point.
And that took us back to a town called Kursk. And in Kursk, there's a missile brigade called the 53rd Air Defense Brigade. And we're able to establish for certain the missile launcher came from that particular brigade.
And Kursk is in Russia. And the 53rd Brigade is a Russian military unit.
Yes, and it was probably very likely crewed by Russian crew.
Higgins also discovered the missile system retreating after the shootdown with one incriminating difference.
You're saying that there's a missile missing from this picture.
That's right. So there's one there, and there's one just out the back of there as well. But there should be a missile between these two missiles.
It wasn't long before Elliot Higgins got a call from Dutch investigators.
How important was the information that came from Bellingcat?
That was pretty groundbreaking at that time. So we've learned a lot from them as well. But that's just one layer of the evidence, because we have to build up evidence that can stand in court. We also have the witnesses, forensic evidence, etc.
The investigators told us layers of evidence came from the weapon itself. Its missile warhead is packed with a unique bowtie-shaped shrapnel. This signature shrapnel was found in the bodies of the flight crew. Another layer of evidence came in thousands of phone calls intercepted among Russians and their allies. We have just shot down a plane, a rebel commander said, before realizing the catastrophic mistake. Yet another layer of evidence was supplied by Ukrainian villagers.
You have eyewitnesses to the missile launch, is that correct? More than one?
I'd say I have an eyewitness, and how many? I didn't say how many.
What military unit did the missile system come from?
From the 53rd Brigade of the Armed Forces of the Russian Federation.
Is there any room for doubt in that?
No, there's no doubt at all.
They don't know who pushed the button, but this past summer, Dutch prosecutors charged three Russians and a Ukrainian with 298 counts of murder. Sergei Dubinsky was head of intelligence for the pro-Russia rebels in Ukraine.
Prosecutors say Oleg Pulatov and Leonid Karchenko were involved in delivering the missile system. The highest-ranking Russian accused is Igor Gherkin, a retired colonel in Russian intelligence. He was in charge of the pro-Russia militia in Ukraine. We found him in Moscow, living under the protection of the Russian government. He told us, someone has to be the scapegoat, so they picked me and others who couldn't even theoretically shoot down this plane. The militia did not bring down the Boeing plane. I have no other comment.
How helpful have the Russians been in this investigation over the last 5 years?
Well, I'd say they haven't been helpful at all, because what they should have done is give us all the information and all the proof we needed in this difficult investigation. They should have told us that at the second day after it happened. They should have told us we made a mistake or we did something which shouldn't have happened, and they should have come forward. That is what they should have done, and they never did.
Still unhelpful, the Russians will not extradite the defendants.
If they're convicted, even though they're not in the courtroom, is that enough for you?
No.
Everybody will be haunted by the fact that they're still out there and not in custody.
The trial is scheduled to begin March 9th and will be heard by a panel of three Dutch judges. Samira Kaler told us she will not attend. Pete Ploeg will not miss it.
The families have the right to speak in court, and I wonder what you intend to say.
I want them to know what they have done, and what they have done to the not only to the victims, but also the next of kin. They have to feel it.
Prosecutors told us their investigation is continuing beyond the trial. They hope to charge additional suspects. For its part, Russia has spun any number of stories about what might have killed 298 innocent victims, stories that so far have not withstood the evidence presented by the silent witness of Malaysia Flight 17.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Every so often, someone so young does something so amazing, you can't help but wonder, how do they do that? That's what happened the first time we heard Matthew Whitaker play piano. Matthew is a jazz pianist who is blind, and since the age of 11, he's been performing around the world. He's been called a prodigy, and his talent is so extraordinary, he's also caught the attention of scientists who are now studying his brain and trying to understand his vision of music. Whitaker doesn't just play music, he plays with it. Twisting melodies, crafting complex harmonies, and improvising at lightning speed. It's acoustic acrobatics performed over 88 keys, and it is not for the faint of heart. This past spring, Matthew made his first appearance at the New Orleans Jazz Festival. We watch backstage with his dad. The sheer complexity and spontaneity of his sets.
Yeah!
Like this Look Ma, No Hands moment make the most seasoned musician sweat and jazz fans go wild. He plays with his shoes off so he can feel the pedals and his head turned so he can feel the crowd.
This New Orleans Jazz Fest, this is the Tiffany of jazz festivals. Was this a dream?
It is amazing to be here. Like, this is where jazz started.
Do you get nervous before a big show like this?
honestly, right, I was a tiny bit nervous, but, you know, once I started playing, I felt good.
Jazz Fest is a jambalaya for the senses.
It's a lot of music coming at you.
It's a lot.
We negotiated our way through the thick roux of humidity, suffocating crowds, and the 14 stages of music that often boil over into the fairgrounds.
Can you hear all the different stages? Are you like, is this like overwhelming?
Right, yeah.
We're right behind the tuba.
But as we walked around, we noticed Matthew was able to cut through the sensory assault and identify songs in seconds.
He's playing Just a Tulsa. Just a Tulsa, walked with thee.
You got that song just that quickly?
Yeah.
I heard like three notes and you already know what song it is? Lord.
Matthew grew up in Hackensack, New Jersey.
He's just happy all the time.
His parents, Moses and May Whitaker, say Matthew had an ear for music before he could even talk.
Tell me about the first time he picked up an instrument.
He was playing Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, but he was playing it with both hands. Matt was playing the chords and the melody of the song itself.
Had he had a lesson at this point?
He hadn't had a lesson or anything. He was 3 years old. So my question was, okay, who showed him how to do that? Somebody had to show Matthew how to play this song, and nobody showed him.
Matthew Whitaker was born at 24 weeks. He weighed 1 pound, 11 ounces. His parents were told he had less than a 50% chance of survival. One of the many complications he faced was retinopathy of prematurity, a disease which can lead to blindness.
I think at the time I didn't think he was going to make it, so it was, you know, just very scary.
May and Moses Whitaker watched helplessly as Matthew braved 11 surgeries to try and save his sight. After 2 anxious years, they decided they didn't want Matthew to endure anymore, even if it meant he'd be permanently blind.
We just felt like he was going through too much. We were going through too much because the doctors weren't saying it was getting any better. We said, you know what? That's enough. We'll just deal with it as it is.
They told you he might not even speak?
Exactly. They said that he might not crawl and he might not ever walk because he needed those things to see. You know, most kids, they learn to walk because they want to try to get to something. Well, Matthew couldn't see to get to anything. So a lot of his toys and stuff, we had to have sounds so that he would want to crawl, want to reach to those things.
Matthew did start crawling towards music, sometimes sliding up to the speaker to feel the music. No one in his family was a musician, but his grandfather bought him his first keyboard when he was 3 years old.
How complicated were the songs he was playing early on?
They were nursery rhymes more so than anything. So they weren't that complicated, but what he was doing was complicated because most kids don't play with both hands and they don't play the chords and the harmonies and all of that. And Matt was doing that.
So you realize he's got a gift.
Yes.
Let's get him a teacher.
Yes, which was the difficult part.
Why was that the difficult part?
Because at the time, we got a lot of answers where people were saying, he's too young. And he was 3 years old at the time. Or, well, I don't know how to teach a blind child.
When you do this guy...
Dahlia Sackis agreed to meet Matthew. Sackis is the director of music studies at the Philemon M. D'Agostino Greenberg Music School in New York City, a school for the visually impaired.
So we brought him over, and Dahlia played something on the piano, and Matt repeated it. Then she played something else, and Matt repeated it. She said, bring him in. We'll make the exception.
Everybody say, hey.
Dahlia has been teaching Matthew ever since. She is a classically trained concert pianist.
I was performing a couple of recitals, and the Dvorak Piano Quintet is a piece actually for piano and string quartet. So there's 5 of us. So Matt and his mom came to hear, you know, the night I played. He comes in Saturday morning, I walk into the studio, and he's playing the opening of the Dvorak Quintet, you know. And then the cello comes in, and he knew the whole thing, and I thought, oh, no, very nice.
Dvorak's Piano Quintet is a challenging piece for 5 musicians. Matthew was playing his version of all 5 parts on his piano.
Can he listen to a piece of music for the first time and then play it? Does he have that ability?
Yeah.
Just hearing it once?
Yeah, he can pretty much get it.
That's insane.
Yeah, it is insane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It could be exhausting.
Yeah, well, it was scary more than exhausting.
Why scary?
Because you didn't want to blow it. Because you have someone of this talent, of this creativity, this enthusiasm. You don't want to squelch that. You don't want to mess up. He's obviously, you know, got something to offer to the world. And so you want to make that possible.
She did. By the time he was 11, Matthew was performing around the world. His first paying gig was in Capri, Italy, where he cut his chops with seasoned jazz musicians. Since then, he's played in more than 200 clubs and concert halls around the world. That caught the attention of Dr. Charles Lim. Lim, a musician himself, is a surgeon and neuroscientist who uses MRI brain scans to better understand how exceptionally creative people do what they do.
What's interesting about a kid like Matthew? Why do you want to look at his brain? You
know, I think anytime somebody watches Matthew play piano, the first thing that you think is, how does he do that? Except rather than just wondering and actually trying to answer the question.
Specifically, Dr. Lim wants to know why the brains of certain artists seem better wired to give rise to new ideas. In Matthew's case, improvising. But when Dr. Lim approached the Whitakers, they were dubious.
Because somebody comes to you and says, can we put your son in this scan? And right away you're thinking, you know, lab rabbit or, you know, what are they trying to do with my child?
Once Dr. Lim also explained other artists had participated, the Whitakers agreed to let him scan Matthew's brain. He brought Matthew to this MRI facility at the University of California, San Francisco, and put Matthew in the scanner with a mini keyboard on his lap.
Okay, should we give it a shot?
Yep.
Matthew played a melody with his feet keeping time while Dr. Lim and his team recorded his brain's activity levels with the MRI scanner.
What you're seeing on this computer screen is some brain data that we obtained from Matthew.
Then Dr. Lim put Matthew through a different series of auditory tests. He showed us the results.
And so we started out not by looking at music, but by looking at somebody like this who would give a lecture that most people would consider to be a little bit boring.
In an effort to alleviate the effect of the... Anyone?
And this is what happened when he was listening to that. And then, interestingly, because he is blind, we looked at his visual cortex, and we didn't see any significant activity there at all.
So nothing's happening.
Exactly. And then we switched the soundtrack for him, and we put on a band that he knows quite well, Snarky Puppy. This is what changes in his brain.
Jeez. Lights up.
Look closely. This is his visual cortex listening to the boring lecture, and this is it. Listening to music.
Pretty remarkable. His entire brain is stimulated by music. His visual cortex is activated throughout. It seems like his brain is taking that part of the tissue that's not being stimulated by sight and using it, or maybe helping him to perceive music with it.
So he's using that visual part of his brain to kind of see music, as it were?
Exactly, yeah. And so it's sort of borrowing that part of the brain and rewiring it to help him hear music.
When they told you that your visual cortex of your brain
lit up, for music, like, that was amazing. I didn't even know that was happening.
What do you think it means?
I love music.
1, 2, 3, 4.
His love of music has never been in doubt. But Matthew's teacher, Delia Sakis, wanted to make sure Matthew wasn't just a flash-in-the-pan prodigy.
I know. Keep going. You'll get it.
She wanted him to be a literate musician.
Where's the second beat?
So she decided needed to learn to read Braille music. To do that, you have to feel, read, and remember dots that represent the music, first for the right hand, and then for the left hand. It's a painstakingly slow process.
How far do you want to go to?
I don't know. Let's keep just going, okay?
And Matthew does not like to slow down.
Stay still.
When we interviewed him, he was exceedingly polite and exceedingly bored.
I'm so sorry.
You're fine.
Matthew just wants to play.
May I go to the piano?
So he did. piano, he is pure joy, jumping from the classics to Beyoncé. But what's so special is how he takes those songs, any song.
Oh, you're speaking to my soul now.
Improvising it on the spot to make it his own. Matthew's latest album is called Now Hear This. His vision of music that a critic noted sounds like Matthew is playing with six hands.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
In the mail this week, comments on our story, The Server, which trace the origins of President Trump's unproven charges that Ukraine is concealing a Democratic Party computer server in that country. The segment on Ukraine, CrowdStrike, Russia, and Trump was so informative, you took a complicated story and made it plain and simple. Thanks. It was brave. Other viewers disagreed. Y'all are at it again. You just won't leave President Trump alone. We are sick and tired of hearing all that mess about Ukraine. Let's move on. I'm Scott Pelley. We'll be back next week with another edition of 60 Minutes.
I'm CBS News correspondent Major Garrett, host of the podcast Agent of Betrayal, The Double Life of Robert Hansen. During the Cold War, FBI agent Robert Hansen traded classified secrets to the Kremlin in exchange for cash and jewels. In the podcast, you'll hear from Hansen's closest friends, family members, victims, and colleagues for the most comprehensive telling of who Robert Hansen really was. Binge the entire series now. Agent of Betrayal, The Double Life of Robert Hansen is available on the Wondery app, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Don't miss true crime anytime you want, anywhere you go, with the 48 Hours Podcast. Real crimes.
Like a John Grisham novel come to life.
Real lives.
He pointed a gun to me and said, "This is the day you die." And he shot me.
Real justice.
There's some questions that have to be asked and need to be answered.
I'm an innocent man, and I hope the whole world can see it now.
Catch the latest episodes of 48 Hours wherever you get your podcasts.
The Hargan women seem to have it all.
From the outside looking in, we were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But as detectives would soon learn, there was a lot going on inside the Hargan household.
Ashley and I have been calling my mom and the house and Helen. No one's answering.
63-year-old Pamela Hargan gunned down in her own home. Her youngest daughter, Helen, lay dead upstairs.
Patrol, when they arrived, assumed or thought that there might have been a murder-suicide.
But for the detectives on the scene,
there were things about the scene itself that were concerning to us on day one.
Who would want to kill their mother and their little sister?
There is no boogeyman here. It is exactly who we think it is.
I'm Peter Van Sant from 48 Hours. This is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, early and ad-free on the 48 Hours Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts.